Okay, so welcome to week two of our four-week series, Exploring Consciousness. So before I say anything else, the format of the evening tonight is it's going to revolve around these comfy chairs here. That's all I'll say, okay? Well, at least the first part is anyway, because tonight we're going to be looking at consciousness largely from the philosophical perspective. Last week we looked at consciousness largely from the scientific perspective, and I've got some slides to remind you of what we went through last week. So I'm going to remind you, those of you who are here, just a quick 17-slide summary of what were 50 slides in 10 minutes, what were 55 slides from last week, and then we're going to go into the comfy chair format, where we're going to have a dialogue between a philosophical perspective on consciousness with a bit of interjection from a Buddhist. From somebody who's still grappling with Buddhism. Now, as I said last week, the reason why we're doing this, this series of talks, is because we're very, very interested in the central teaching of Buddhism, which is Pratityasamutpada, condition arising and condition falling. You know, things come into being and they pass away. And this is a teaching which is going to fascinate me, compel me, etc., for the rest of my life. Now, I see science as a way into my more direct practices of exploring this great vision of Buddhism, you know, the direct practices, for example, of meditation or going on retreat. And, you know, the more kind of ways I can make consciousness, which is the stuff of Buddhism, of course, interesting, the better. Because I think fascination with something makes something much more compelling and much more engaging. Okay, so before we go on to the philosophical perspective, that's all I need to say, is it? Yep, okay. This is Chris, by the way. Chris is getting very, very comfortable. But in 10 minutes, he's going to be more uncomfortable because he's going to be sitting there. Okay, so quick summary starting from now, 27 minutes. So we started off with a definition. Well, what is consciousness? You've got to start talk. It's good to start off with definitions. So we saw that consciousness derives from the Latin conscientia, which primarily means moral conscience, which is quite interesting, or in the literal sense, shared knowledge. So immediately it's saying that conscience maybe has something to do with others, you know, with our interaction with the others in the world. And we also saw that the Oxford Dictionary is a bit drier, and awareness of something. We also saw that consciousness is nothing new. You know, mankind has been interested and fascinated by consciousness for ever since consciousness arose, I guess. And even in the 1500s, we saw that they were doing some deep dissections of the brain, trying to understand what kind of structure of the brain might support consciousness. And, you know, any kind of consideration of consciousness must take into account the qualities of consciousness, and I listed some subjectivity. You know, we're all experiencing now. We're all experiencing sensations in the body. We're all experiencing feelings and thoughts. Subjectivity. Me, you. Self-awareness. And we're aware of, we can make ourselves more or less aware of any particular experience which we're having now, of our thoughts, our feelings, sensations of the body. So another quality of consciousness is sentience. You know, perception. Perception through the senses. And another quality is sapience. You know, we can have intelligent interactions with ourselves, with others, and with the world. And another quality of consciousness which I listed was the ability to perceive relationships between oneself and one's environment. So any kind of exploration of consciousness, kind of, it's quite interesting to say, well, what actually we're trying to explore, and that was a little list there. Now, I set the perspective right away because I think it's very important to realise that, yes, we might be walking on the street thinking, you know, we're fantastic as Homo sapiens, which we are, but what I pointed out last week, right from the start, was that we're actually standing on millions of shoulders. You know, we're not. And this was my first example of conditionality, that, you know, if you reduce life on this earth, or the history of the Earth into a 24-hour clock. We arose, Homo sapiens sapiens arose at 1159. So we've only been around, Homo sapiens has only been around a minute amount of the history of the Earth and the history of life. And life is predicted to have arisen around 12 minutes past 3. So a lot of things have been going on for Homo sapiens to rise at 1159. And I also said, you know, us, Homo sapiens, are totally dependent upon plants. Plants are the only organisms on this planet which can capture the sunlight and convert it into energy, which we then use either directly by eating plants themselves or indirectly if you eat animals. So the point is that we're standing on millions and millions of years of conditionality. Don't take that for granted. So we saw that around about 6 million years ago, the common ancestor gave rise to chimpanzees and Homo sapiens. Now, the chimpanzees are the closest relative of Homo sapiens. And that happened about 6 million years ago. And then we looked at the human evolution itself, as although we've only been around a minute, relatively speaking, around about Homo sapiens has been around about 200,000 years. Again, we're standing on a lot of kind of evolution in terms of hominid species. There's been quite a few of hominid species around, which we're one of. And interestingly, you know, we're just this little blip here. Whereas something like Homo erectus was around for 2-3 million years, and they died out. And so nothing is guaranteed. You know, there's us, a little blip. There's Homo erectus, 3 million years around 3 million years ago, but they died out, as did quite a few early hominid species. So there's nothing guaranteed. And we also looked at the evolution of consciousness in terms of art. You know, like consciousness allows us, one of the qualities, to interact with ourselves and the world. And we looked at this one example of a very early example of art, 30,000 years old. And what it shows is that the fact that you've got a feline face on top of a human body suggested that gives it gives circumstantial evidence of the ability of the artist to think abstractly. And that's another quality of consciousness. So abstract thinking, you know, it allows us to leave our kind of focus and go away somewhere else, but still think about that thing which we were looking at. So 30,000 years ago, you know, consciousness was producing some wonderful... I couldn't do that. I don't know if you could. I couldn't. I wouldn't have a clue, to chip away. So you also had to have tools. We also looked at the fact that the evolution of the brain... And now, I made an assumption that the human brain is primary in supporting consciousness, okay? Whether you agree or not, whether I agree or not with that, or whether you agree or not, that was something which we debated. But if we assume that the brain is one of the primary conditions or processes which supports consciousness, then it's very interesting to look at the evolution of the human brain itself. And what we saw is that the evolution of the whole human brain has been in terms of size, but also in terms of structure. Now, both of them are very important. The structure enabled new structures arose in the human brain, which we looked at, which kind of give it or support particular aspects of consciousness, for example, emotions. So it wasn't just size, it was also these are to scale, by the way, it was also the structures of the brain which were important. We also looked at this wonder of evolution, the neuron. The neuron is the fundamental building block of the brain. Now, this cell had to evolve from a circular cell. So it's been, as we saw last week, it's been stretched out, it's been put on some little hairy bits on the top and at the bottom. So, you know, this basic fundamental building block of the brain is a wonder of evolution. you know, what it does, it transmits electrical and chemical signals throughout the brain. And then we went on to start looking at the structure of the brain itself and what kind of, you know, how the structure of the brain, at least scientifically, could support, or suggestions on how the structure of the brain could support consciousness. So, you know, there's a lot going on in the brain at any one time. Sensations, movement, judgment, reward, you know, for what we, those kind of behaviour patterns which support our survival, vision, coordination, pain, etc. And what we saw last week is different parts of the brain apparently support different things. So the primitive brain, just on sitting on top of the top of the spinal cord, is primitive. It arose probably about 600 million years ago, and it's to do with self-preservation, the fight flight kind of thing. And then the next kind of brain structures to arise is what's called the limbic system, and that's to do with emotions, how we feel. And the last bit of the human brain to evolve was the what's called the neocortex, the stuff on top of the brain. It's huge, it's massive in us, and it allows us to do some intellectual tasks. And what we saw is that current theories of consciousness, at least from a scientific perspective, is saying it's not just one part of the brain which is supporting consciousness. It's different parts, but they're communicating with each other. So the way which we emote influences how we think, and vice versa. And the influences, the conditionality which is going on in the brain is to do with how these different parts of the brain communicate with each other. And nothing is fixed. I mean, you can say a lot of things is fixed, but what we saw last week is that we can, you know, the neural connections in the brain, they're not necessarily fixed. You know, so we used the example of learning a human language last week. You know, we can all learn a human language, and that requires new neurons in the brain making new connections. So nothing, you know, we can learn. We can learn meditation. We can through the years, etc. And one of the main theory which we looked at was that of Edelman, who's a prominent neuroscientist, and he started putting forward theories of consciousness in the late 80s. And he came up. He purports that in the brain there's what's called a dynamic core, and anything which is in the dynamic core is conscious. Anything outside of the dynamic core is unconscious. So the dynamic core is kind of, if he talks in terms of a ball of energy, which is kind of holding our experience together into an integrated whole. But it's flexible, you know. So whatever is in the dynamic core, we're conscious of. And it's changing, you know. The activity in the brain is changing pretty constantly. So what we're feeling is changing. And this is the final slide. And I have done it in 10 minutes. So what I was kept coming back to is that, you know, this quote by Karl Popper, he said, knowledge and understanding advance not through asking for definitions of what things are, but through asking why they occur and how they work. So I am not a reductionist, okay? I'm not saying that, you know, if we can fully understand the brain, we can fully understand consciousness. If we can fully define the brain and define what this does and that does and that does, we'll be able to assemble the jigsaw puzzle together and say, aha, now I understand consciousness, because I don't think that's true. I think there's a, you know, we were exploring last week, this mysterious element of consciousness. And what Buddhism does, I think, is not necessarily to try and define things. It's, well, how things work, you know. If we're skillful, that's what happens. If we're unskillful, that's what happens. So that's the spirit of these talks. So that's the scientific perspective, very, very, very briefly. We covered a lot of material last week, and those are the salient points, I thought. So what we're going to do now is we're going to explore consciousness through a philosophical perspective. Yeah? And for that, we're going to put the lights up, and Chris is going to sit here. So I'd like to introduce you to Chris. So I've known Chris now about, 3 years? 3 years. And he's in the study group, actually, on Thursday night. So if you want to know what it's like coming into a men's study group, you can ask Chris afterwards. I'm sure he'd be delighted to answer questions on that, as well as the philosophical perspective of consciousness. So Chris studied philosophy. Was it Cambridge? Oxford. At Oxford. So... Sorry. I should have done my homework. Obviously, my dynamic core was not in the region of what Chris said last week. So, Chris, I invited Chris to come and say something about the philosophical perspective of consciousness, because I don't know that much, and I thought I'd ask somebody who does. So, the way this is going to work is Chris is going to say things, right, and I'm going to, if I'm quick enough, to pick up some points and say, well, actually, from a Buddhist perspective, this is it. So if you wouldn't mind, if you could just let us do the dialoguing, and then what we'll do, when it's over, we'll have a cup of tea, and then it's your chance, all right? Like last week, it'd be your chance to say, I agree with this, I disagree with this. Actually, I think you haven't told the whole story. Now, last week, we had the discussion for a full hour, so let's see what we can do this week. But first, we'll dialogue with the philosopher.
Well, of course, to say I studied philosophy at Oxford sounds very grand. I've been telling Maharshi Shraddha off with this. But I did, but it was a long time ago, so I've now concluded that the brain consists entirely of cogs. And mine are quite rusty. Anyway, let's give it a go. It's a massive, massive subject. We're just going to look at a few ideas here. And a lot of this will consist of raising questions. Because the answers are many and varied over a very long period of time, and people are still arguing about it. In fact, lots of philosophers have just given up arguing about it because they feel they can't really make a lot of headway. So, I'd say, what could be more certain to each of us that we are conscious? But what is this consciousness like? And how can this phenomenon be contained in a physical body within a physical world? Consciousness is a very strange thing. It has a strange anomaly at its heart. All natural phenomena are at least theoretically equally accessible to any observer. But any particular case of consciousness has only privileged access by that individual. For this reason and many others, we have no really good theory of consciousness and not even a clear description of what this phenomenon comprises. Consciousness raises many baffling questions, and I'm going to mention a few here and break it up in the middle. For example, are animals conscious? And if so, is it in the same way as we are? Secondly, for example, could a robot or computer be conscious? Perhaps not one we have now, but theoretically, we might be able to design one that is. These first two questions, and I'll come on to a few more, give rise to an ethical question. I was thinking about this on how we treat other entities and how we do that, and the extent to which the way we treat them may well depend on the extent to which we think they are conscious. Buddhists are generally vegetarian because they respect the consciousness of animals, or perhaps that's the reason they're vegetarian. But perhaps we also feel that other creatures have differing levels of consciousness, and this warrants different types of behavior from ourselves. So some people will be very kind to our higher order animals and care little for lower order animals. What's that based on? We all have these assumptions that we just say, oh, yeah, you know that an ant is worth little, but a rabbit is worth a lot, and a monkey's worth a lot more. Well, where do we get all that from? Now, another few. Could a person have unconscious thoughts, sensations, pains, perceptions? We'll come back to that. Are we conscious when we dream? Well, yeah. I'll give that one a miss for the moment. We might talk about it later. And might a human being harbour more than one conscious agent within their brain? Some of what Maharshi Shraddha says could slightly imply that, and I think we'll come back to that conclusion in a way. Anyway, there's little doubt that much more will be learnt from empirical discoveries over time, but will it ever really explain consciousness and what it is like to be conscious? Now, the concept of consciousness, I'm going to split into two things here, viewed from the inside and viewed from the outside. So firstly, viewed from the inside, we have no problem accepting that much goes on inside our brain and body of which we are unaware. That's quite usual. We're sure lots of things are happening. We don't know exactly what they are. But it seems nothing can be more intimately known to us than those things of which we are conscious. The things of which I am conscious and the ways in which I am conscious of them determine what it is like to be me. When we are conscious and fully awake, that we are conscious is in no doubt. It also seems to be true that all things around us divide into one of two categories: things that are and things that are not conscious. Bricks and calculators do not have an inner life, which is a term sometimes used for consciousness, or a point of view, again that. Or to put it another way, it is like something to be me or you, but not an inanimate object. Now, viewed from the outside, consideration of others by us is, of course, necessarily from the outside. People seem to do as we do, react to their sensory inputs, act to avoid pain, learn information, solve problems, etc. Generally exhibit what we call intelligence. However, in saying this, we are assuming what we are observing is the same as we experience, but we cannot prove this. In fact, it would be theoretically possible to design a robot that explained its own experiences and its reactions, but most people would presume that a robot was still not conscious. Perhaps other humans are like us because they are organically similar. But there again, a robot could be constructed to be functionally similar to a human being, or theoretically far in the future. So that raises the question, why therefore do we think that some similarities confirm consciousness and others don't? Again, the extent to which we perceive similarities in behaviour with others may generate an unfortunate tendency to hierarchical treatment of other human beings based on what we presume is the level of their consciousness or sensibilities. So again, we're seeing similarities between our behaviour and theirs, and then we're judging, we're reading back, we're saying, oh, if I could do that, or speak in that way, or paint in that way, or whatever, that would say something about my level of consciousness. They would say things about what's going on in my brain, but if you could do that, would that say exactly the same as what's going in your brain? Perhaps not at all. What this amounts to is a presumption that various outside indicators imply the presence of what each conscious entity knows from the inside. But this cannot be confirmed. For ourselves, our inner life and our outwardly observable perceptions appear to coincide. Can this coincidence be confirmed of others? And if not, we are all doomed to be solipsists, as the well-known old theory, philosophical theory. A solipsist is a belief that only one's own experiences and existence can be known with certainty. Live a rather strange life if you are one of those. A person telling you of the coincidence of their outer and inner brain experiences, or mind experiences, so we say, effectively confirms nothing at all, because it is all outside to us. If a person over there says to me, oh yes, when you do that to me, I also feel that, well, that's just a report to me. I can't confirm that they're feeling it. They're just telling me that they're feeling it. And that again, is this strange aspect of consciousness, that it's unconfirmable from the outside by neutral observers. So therefore, we can be fooled that there is a special inner light present in everybody. But perhaps there is just darkness inside everybody else, and I'm just talking to myself. I don't know, you see. It's worrying, I thought. Anyway, in which case, we might as well not bother to record this. Anyway, I was thinking, perhaps then the Buddhist practice, I was talking to Marshall about this the other day, the Buddhist practice of metta is of great importance. If that is a possibility, that you could even think that, then metta tries to bridge that common humanity between us and basically assumes that the other person has what you have and brings you closer together. So a very powerful practice, and lead you away from thinking that you're the only one with the consciousness, which would be an unfortunate thought. Now I want to mention something I call the revolution of the unconscious. Basically in the 17th century, the philosopher John Locke, a very clever Englishman, from the period of Enlightenment, when there were a lot of good English, or British philosophers, should I say, David Hume being another one, he was Scottish, Locke and subsequent thinkers claimed that what is essential to the mind is consciousness, and more specifically, self-consciousness. The mind's activities are transparent to itself. And on the face of it, that seems true. If I think something, only I know it, and I see it clearly. So it seems true. But of course, Freud exploded all of this, and Freud and others, of course, but he's the one who's most famous for it, with his hypothesis of the unconscious mind. A view that at the time met with incredulity and denial. How could there be beliefs, desires, or feelings that were unknown to introspection? This raises the interesting question of what having a belief is, if one is currently unaware of it. I started to think about this and think, what a strange idea. I have beliefs in this and that. But if I'm not, if the dynamic core isn't engaging with these beliefs, well, what does that mean? It's a very strange idea that maybe they're just printed into memory.
So this is raising the question as we're talking about faith.
Yeah.
You were saying that if you're not aware of something, where does that faith go? If you're not aware of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I mean, the scientific perspective would say, well, you know, it would still be there. It's just that the dynamic core is not, you know, it's not being included in the dynamic core.
Then that's strange, because then the belief is just a memory, isn't it?
Mm.
Which is, well, yeah, it's an odd idea. Perhaps we have to constantly, I mean, the Buddhism would say, well, how about, you know, we do meditation and we increase our awareness. That's what you're trying to do. So the awareness there is re-exposing our own beliefs to ourselves, to our dynamic core, pulling them up and looking at them, pulling them up and looking at them, not only beliefs, all sorts of things. And I guess we concluded that one of the most important reasons for that is to try and give one some consistency of behavior. Otherwise, you would be reinventing these beliefs every single time you came across a situation. The more aware you are, the more consistent you are keeping your beliefs in front of your mind. This aside, many patterns of human behavior are explained by unseen, unconscious phenomena, and as a result, the concept of unconsciousness eventually became well accepted. And that was the main reason. It just explained so many things so successfully. The unconsciousness got accepted fairly rapidly after that. Consequently, we've come to accept that a vast amount of information processing occurs within us all the time, and it's entirely inaccessible to inward inspection, mostly. But more controversially, perhaps, some activities may be accessible to outsiders more than they are to the owners of the minds in which the activities take place, which is a rather strange idea. But it's true. We all know the problem. You can't see the wood for the trees. You know, things are going on. You can't see things clearly. And also, a clever psychologist like Freud, or more advanced since then, really, can look at your behavior and say what it is you are thinking, basically. And you may not be aware of what you are thinking. You may think you are, but you may not. So it's very strange. There's this whole world going on, doing things in the brain, but doing higher things in a way. I think that's quite a strange thing from coming out from, you know, your descriptions of the brain there. you tend to think of these lower areas coping with all the, you know, the functions, arms and legs and everything else and eating and so on, and this higher bit that's clearly aware of everything and so on. But even that isn't quite correct, because there's loads of complicated stuff going on, even fairly high up functions, and you're still not aware of them if, of course, as you say, the dynamic core isn't looking at that particular area at any one time. So it appears that we have many non-conscious subsystems functioning within our minds, entirely lacking an inner life of their own. Perhaps you could call this mindless but intelligent machines, not unlike computers. This is now, of course, the exact reverse of what of Locke's idea, the feeling that the unconscious mentality was incomprehensible. For it raises a further challenge to consciousness. If mentality need not be conscious, there's much mentality going on, very higher brain functions carrying on, controlling you and eventually even giving rise to thoughts. If they need not be conscious, what actually is the need for consciousness? And that's, well, that's one of the problems that philosophy and science, I think, possibly have come across quite extensively. I don't know whether you've come across that particular idea. It's what actually is the need for consciousness? To what extent could we function without the sort of self-awareness that we have? It's difficult to say for sure. There is a fairly, a newish theory that came along in the 90s about the mind and brain, which maybe we'll come back to, which I was reading just the other day, which has developed a whole new idea about this, which is quite interesting. There's a whole subsection of this area that I haven't got time to go into about the difference between the mind and the brain. Pet topic of mine, but we'll leave off that for a moment. There is a guy called Carl Lashley, an American neuropsychologist, suggested that no activity of the mind is ever conscious. What he meant by this is that all processing of thoughts, all processing altogether in the brain, is invisible. You cannot actually see what the processing is, so however hard you look.
Not being able to see itself, and yet it's still an organ for visual perception.
Yeah, absolutely. You cannot look in on what goes on. You can see, of course, a thought. Well, most people can't see thoughts arising. But actually, I was thinking about that. That's a bit like the pure awareness, isn't it? If you become good at it, at this type of meditation, you can actually begin to see thoughts arise, can't you? Not only realize that you've been thinking something and get rid of it, which is kind of the stage I'm at. But if you're a bit more advanced than it, I think you can actually begin to see them arise, can't you? So then you're not seeing processing, but you are seeing the very early parts of thoughts, aren't you, I guess. So the question is, if there are all these subsystems and they're all interacting, and they've all got these important functions, is there a subsystem that deserves to be called the self? And really, from what you were implying, there isn't.
There isn't.
It's interaction of the subsystems that does that. I want to look briefly at something that Marshall had referred to in his talk, actually, split brain cases. It's a bit ghoulish, but philosophers and scientists have made loads of progress from the afflictions of others, especially people who have all sorts of strange mental defects, I suppose, to be fair. Actually, I remember a really bizarre case when I was studying. I don't know whether you've ever heard this one. There was a guy in America, this is apropos of nothing, really. He was banging a pole into the ground, and there was some old dynamite from a mining operation that had carried on before in the ground, and the pole was about this big. He hit the pole, hit the dynamite, and the pole went straight through his head. Well, he survived, and in fact he survived. He lived on and on and on very happily, and it removed a great big core like that right through the middle of his head, and it just became an absolutely fascinating study for all the psychologists to see what this bit of brain missing actually did to him. Amazingly, the brain, and I think this is perhaps something that you were referring to in a way, the brain compensated. Yes. Of course it couldn't completely compensate, and I think later on all sorts of strange behaviour did begin, but it took months for it to begin to happen. So the brain actually kind of compensated, it went around it, which is interesting. Anyway, that's, I don't know where that came from. So back to the split brain. Yes, if there's a damage, cuts the corpus callosum, which is the part joining the two cerebral hemispheres together. This leads to this gives rise to a person who sort of has somewhat two different independent minds. Not totally different, but they show independent characteristics. The lines of intercommunication have been cut, leading to two separate mind-like entities. The question of interest here is, do both now have an inner life? Perhaps only the dominant half, with the other controlling only subconscious behavioural systems. If, on the other hand, both are supposed to have consciousness, then perhaps there are other processing subsystems of the brain that possess their own inner lives. If the left and the right brain have inner lives, then does this bit have an inner life, or this bit, or this bit, and this bit? You know, maybe all the subsystems, if you isolated other bits, maybe other bits could seem conscious. It's very strange, that one, and it begins to give you the idea that your head's full of different consciousnesses. That's the plural. So that speculation leaves one wondering whether we are made up of a host of conscious entities all interacting and taking part in the conscious and self-conscious experience, which might explain a certain lack of mental integration we often appear to experience in everyday life. I want to sort of make a break here, just to mention the importance of identity in our lives. Identity is, again, another very large philosophical debate. It's been going on for a long time. It appears to be vital to us in everybody's lives that we have a strict feeling of identity. And in Buddhist terms, it is a highly conditioned thing. For example, if one suffers from the onset of amnesia, does the loss of memory that appears to constitute our idea of self mean that the memory loss that we suffer therefore implies our identity has gone? There's been much thought on that subject. Are you the same person if you've lost all of your memory? Well, maybe yes, maybe no. Of course, in this example, the body stays the same, and it must contain some elements of our identity, both from its appearance, continuity of appearance, but also from the internal conditioning that it has effect on the mind. Of course, if you've got the same body, then your brain, without its memories, is going to start to form some similar thought processes and so on. Just because you've got the same body, they interact with each other. Of course, they do. Descartes' notion of... by the way, Descartes was really the person who got most of the mind-brain thinking off to a start. Prior to that, everything was based on the ancient Greek theory, Aristotle mainly, and by modern standards, they were extremely primitive, although very clever at the time. It took a very, very long time before Descartes came along in the, if someone can remember when that was, around the 1700s, I guess, and started to really think about the mind and the brain in a new and modern way. So he kicked off the whole philosophical area of consciousness, really. His notion of a person was that of a particular thinking being, which happened to be, but equally could not be, united with a particular body. One might reasonably ask how such beings are to be identified or re-identified, if not with references to the bodies they occupy. Purely theoretical speculation on ideas of placing one person's mind in another person's body, and vice versa, of course, raises all sorts of questions with regard to which person each one is, and whether their identities are somehow mixed or wholly dependent on where the brain, and thus perhaps the mind, goes. Yeah, you can imagine doing this. I mean, we look at somebody and say, you are you, but really we're largely identifying the body. But of course, if their behaviour changed completely, radically, you would begin to say, hang on, you're not really you anymore. But on the other hand, if you take their brain out and stick it in another body, and that body then starts to do, you know, to act just like the previous person, then you say, oh, you're just like, well, so where is the identity in all of this? As I say, it's a big subject, identity, and not really one for now. Where was I? It might suggest It might be suggested that it is a unity of our consciousness, of our perceptions, including those of our body, that we regard as constituting self, and not so much a matter of identity per se. Returning finally to the subject of where consciousness might lie, I want to, this is just near the end now, to read an article from the Oxford Companion to the Mind, which is an excellent book, an experiment by Lackner and Garrett. I don't know when they did this, but it's not that long ago, I think in the last 10-15 years, which showed a striking example of what one could call multi-consciousness. There's no point in my trying to paraphrase this, so I'll just read it to you. Consider, for example, the striking discovery by J.R. Lackner and M. Garrett of what might be called an unconscious channel of sentence comprehension. In dichotic listening tests, dichotic means, by the way, different. So hearing something different on one ear from the other. In dichotic listening tests, subjects listen through earphones to two different channels and are instructed to attend to just one channel. Typically, they can report with great accuracy what they have heard through the attended channel, but can say little about what was going on concomitantly in the unattended channel. Thus, if the unattended channel carries a spoken sentence, the subjects typically report that they heard a voice or even a male or female voice. Perhaps they even have a conviction about whether the voice is speaking in their native tongue, but they cannot report what was said. In Lackner and Garrett's experiments, subjects heard ambiguous sentences in the attended channel, such as, "He put out the lantern to signal the attack." Well, obviously that sentence can mean different things, different ways you look at it. In the unattended channel, one group of subjects received ambiguous input. "He extinguished the lantern." While another group had neutral or irrelevant input. The former group could not report what was presented through the unattended channel, but they favoured the suggested reading of the ambiguous sentences significantly more than the control group did. Just to explain that, and just in case it isn't clear. So if you use that lantern example, you can read, "He put out the lantern to signal the attack," meaning various things. He snuffed it out, he put it outside, and so on. Whereas there's very little doubt in "he extinguished the lantern" what it means. So if you played "he extinguished the lantern" in the unattended bit, so you don't really know what's going on, whilst also listening, attending to the ambiguous, and then asked the people which version of the ambiguous sentence they had, they understood, they almost all came out with the version that was in the unattended channel, even though when asked, they can't even say they know what the unattended channel said. Quite strange. They favour the suggested reading of the ambiguous sentences significantly more than the control group did. The influence of the unattended channel on the interpretation of the attended signal can be explained only on the hypothesis that the unattended signal is processed all the way to the semantic level, i.e. to the level of understanding. That, in other words, the unattended signal is comprehended. But this is apparently unconscious sentence comprehension. Now, that sounds very strange, really. The whole idea that you can understand people talking sentences and everything and have no idea they were said to you is really quite strange. Or should we say it is evidence of the presence in the subject of at least two different and only partially communicating consciousnesses. If we ask the subjects what it was like to comprehend the unattended channel, they will reply sincerely that it was not like anything to them. They were quite unaware of that sentence. But perhaps, as is often suggested about the split brain patients, there is in effect someone else to whom our question ought to be addressed. Subject who consciously comprehended the sentence has relayed a hint of its meaning to the subject who answers our questions. So, I just thought that was a really rather fascinating experiment. So,
So what do you think the implications of that are? What's it saying?
I think that really leads to the conclusion that language is absolutely vital in development of consciousness. It's very difficult to understand what consciousness without language is. And of course, the joke is you can't ask anybody who hasn't got it what it's like. That would be unfortunate. You certainly can't ask our animals to tell you what their consciousness is like. And there's been a lot of thinking around the subject of how language develops. And I mean, we were talking about that, and I was certainly thinking that language just grows as your consciousness grows, so your language grows with it, so that situations get more complicated, so you need more language to explain it to others, and perhaps to yourself, I think. Mm. I mean, I think probably everybody uses language in their own heads, in their own thoughts. If you didn't have any, it's difficult to know what your consciousness would be like. So, yes, as the book concludes after that particular article, we need to look at the whole situation of consciousness in a different way. That what we have taken to be one phenomena, i.e. personal consciousness, is in fact two quite different ones. The sort of consciousness that's connected to the capacity to say in one's own language what is going on, and the sort of consciousness that is just a matter of intelligent information processing. In other words, adding the capacity to make introspective reports actually changes the phenomena. And that's something that goes through science altogether, doesn't it? The minute you observe something, you've already changed it. So if you have the ability to say anything about your consciousness, you've already altered it in some way. And if you couldn't say it, well, then we wouldn't know anything. So it's a rather circular thing, really. Therefore, one probably has to conclude that human consciousness is somehow tied to our capacity for language. In the end, what consciousness actually is remains a mystery, and maybe no amount of scientific or philosophical investigation will ever truly explain it. Okay, that's that. Can I? Well, I've got time to add a bit about the mind and the brain. The argument's been going about the mind and the brain for a very long time, and Descartes started this off, really. He had the idea that the... there was a brain. We've already, medical science has got that far. We've got brains. They're doing something. They appear to be controlling us in some way. But really, there was also the mind. The mind was a spiritual thing, a thing without any substance. And they weren't connected, really, in his ideas. I was going to say in his mind. That would confuse it. they weren't connected. And in fact, it was later that the famous phrase was coined, and I've completely forgotten who said it. The ghost in the machine, and that's really where it comes from, the idea of this thing in your head that is your mind. And then from that, hundreds of philosophical arguments have flowed. The trouble is, you see, if you go to the scientific, what would seem like the scientific view, you'd say, oh, the mind is, you know, it's, of course there's no strange spiritual thing up there. Ghostly thing. It's just a function of your brain. That's all it is. But of course, that leads to just a completely deterministic view of the world. You know, events arise, and I feel like this, and I see the world like this, and I do that. And if you produced exactly the same events, everything would go exactly the same. You could produce, and then we wouldn't have free will. Which we may or may not have, but we think we have, and that's very important, actually. The fact that you think you have it probably means we do have some level of free will. The opposing view is that, so the mentalists, as they were called, said, no, you're seeing it all the wrong way around. Everything is mental, because all these objects, everything we see, we are perceived by us. So really, they're just ideas anyway. So there is only the mind, and it's the physical that doesn't really exist. That has all sorts of rather strange consequences. I don't think many people really stick with that one anymore. But so how do you get around the fact that we're just machines, which is the sort of implication? And the more recent views have a view. They basically say, of course, the mind, consciousness, thoughts and so on come from the brain. I think it'd be silly to say they don't. But it's not as simple as that. It's not the structure of the brain exactly, and not just the physical inputs coming in through your eyes and everything you hear, but it's the order in which things happen, the speed at which things happen, the interactions with the different parts of the brain that generate, send up effectively the signals, the information and so on, to the higher brain. And the higher brain then has, you know, beliefs and ideas and thoughts and so on, and it then reimposes itself back on the rest of the brain to make you do what you do in response to your beliefs and your inputs and so on. So it's a kind of mixed system. This allows, therefore, to go on studying in a scientific way more and more and more about what the brain actually generates into your mind, so to speak, but still doesn't solve the problem exactly how the mind sends the information back again. So in a way, it is mechanistic, it is physical, but it's extremely difficult to get to how it works, and possibly is still, you'll still never will get there. It's not just a matter of complexity. It's a difficult one to conclude either way. I think we all think that you can't find out exactly who you are and what your consciousness is just by doing more and more scientific experiments. It just doesn't work like that. So, yeah, that's that really.
Well, I suppose we'll have a cup of tea first, and then, because I think there's a lot in there. I mean, I was going, well, I don't actually agree with that, and maybe you do too. But before we have the discussion, we'll go downstairs for a cup of tea first. So the intention of the second half is to have a dialogue. We have not, you know, it's not me and Chris dialoguing with you. It's like we're all dialoguing together about some of the points raised. So. Okay, so we'll finish at 9:30. So if the questions dry up, we'll finish with an exploration of our own consciousness through meditation. Yes, that's very interesting, isn't it? Okay, so I'm going to repeat the questions because it's going to be recorded. So Mahabodhi.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, you mentioned some sort of philosophical positions to do with mind, but are you familiar with phenomenology and that position?
So the question is Chris familiar with phenomenality?
Phenomenal.
Of mind.
Answer, not really. Yes, a term I've come across, a term I've heard, but a term I really remember nothing about. So can you explain it to us then?
There we go.
All right. Well, there's a book called The Embodied Mind, which came out in 1991. And it's by, it's based three scientists. And one of them's a Tibetan Buddhist. He's called Francisco Varela. And he talks about the kind of like dichotomy between cognitive science on the one hand, which is science, how you explain mind, and lived experience on the other. And he says that cognitive science has almost nothing to say about lived experience. In the book, it goes into, you know, developments in cognitive science. So he talks about three phases of the theory of mind. The first one is called is this sort of idea of mind being a function of like the brain or something like that. So that's cognitivism. So that's where you get, you know, mind is like a computer. But since then, there've been other developments which are kind of more about how the mind is actually a kind of a product of the body as well. So it's a movement away from this sort of the mind is a load of logic circuits towards there's an interaction between mind and body, and you know body has a big sort of effect on it. So the philosophical school that he kind of like uses to back this up is something called phenomenology, and. Basically, there's a guy called Heidegger, and he came out with a book called Being and Time in the 1920s. And his basic position is that, well, phenomenology, ology is like logos, which means word or meaning, and the phenomena bit is like, well, just phenomena. So it's a bit like what you can say about phenomena, about your experience, if you don't have any theories about it. So what can you say about your experience without any of that? And all you can say really is that you're here, you know. You appear here in the world as if you've been thrown here, he says. And so he describes everything from the point of view of, like, well, what you can say about experience from experience. It goes on to sort of say that, well, what's the remedy to this position that you're in? And he says that, well, what can you do, you know, when you just find yourself in the world? What you do is you care for yourself, or you care about that. So there's something sort of, there's a bit of a dichotomy between philosophy that's sort of, well, what's called analytical philosophy on the one hand, which is all about sort of theories about experience or theories about existence and stuff. And this other thing called phenomenology, which is like about experience, you know, what you can say from that point of view. And I think the analytical side has consequences, and it leads you to be a bit kind of disembodied or a bit sort of disconnected from, you know, your experience. And I think that leads you to be a bit disconnected from anybody else's experience or animals' experience or whatever, you know. So it's a bit like it has a consequence. And I think the consequence of taking more the phenomenological point of view is that you're aware, you know, you're aware that you're there in your experience, and you kind of take it more seriously. I am experiencing. Oh, I'm here in the world. I can't abstract myself out of it. I'm here, you know. And other people are here as well, you know, and they can't abstract, you know. They're there with their experience, you know. So I think that has a consequence, quite a Buddhist consequence, of putting you much more in touch with yourself and other people as centres of experience. So I think, you know, from a Buddhist point of view, you know, coming down to what Maharshadi was saying about praticca-samuppada, or dependent originality, origination, condition co-production, it's like things are kind of condition each other. I think a way of looking at this is that it's like lived experience on the one hand, and, you know, cognitive science, or it's like how you frame things and stuff, condition each other. You know, you can't abstract the one or abstract the other. You're there with both, you know. So it's a bit like, you know, you need to be, you know, I mean, Heidegger says something like, you can't have a theory about what makes theory possible, which is that you're here, you know, that you have a body, that you're embodied. So the whole, you know, he criticises Western philosophy back to Plato and Aristotle for turning being into a thing, you know, to talk about, basically. So prior to that, it was just being, you know, as your experience. But if you turn it into a thing, you put it at a distance, and then, you know, yeah, as I said, you have these consequences of being able to sort of discount it a bit, or, you know, it distances. I think it has an effect on your ethics and stuff.
And it turned Descartes on his head as well, really.
Yeah, and there's a strong critique of Descartes as well. In fact, there's a book called Descartes' Error. So. Okay, that's my contribution.
Actually, I just wanted to say something from personal experience on that. I found that studying Western philosophy made me very, very cold. After 3 years when I came out of university, I felt really like a machine almost. Mm. And as you say, analysing, putting everything out there and analysing it, and then not being anything yourself at all. Everything was, it's like an object, not the subject. And it's all those years, and it was a long time ago, but only when I came to coming to this place 3.5 years ago, that I began to see a philosophy that was a philosophy or way of living. Because, you know, you could go to lectures on ethics and all sorts, and then come out and feel nothing at all, and do completely different actions that weren't in any way connected with what you've been talking about. There was no overall encompassing indication of why you should act in any particular way. And I've only seen that in Buddhism, actually. So that's the first thing that stirred up a reason to come here. Really.
Can I add something there as well? I mean, I would just like to emphasise that point from scientific point of view. I have some involvement in medical genetics, and the influence the influence of new genetic technology upon ethical decisions, which undoubtedly society will have to face pretty soon. You know, like, for example, the more genes which are identified to contribute to a particular disease, the more tests a child can have, both before birth and after birth. And that's going to raise all kinds of ethical decisions. But we're going down that route. We're going down that route. And I've sat on some, been involved in some discussions recently about what are the principles to set, you know, to frame ethics, you know, to help people make decisions. And the, you know, a bit at sea, really. And I just, you know, keep coming back to, you know, it's something I take for granted, how clear Buddhism is about ethical principles. And I think I've taken it for granted over the years, but now that I'm not so much in Buddhist circles, I think, blimey, you know, Buddhism is very, very clear about ethical principles. And it's something, you know, it's something which I feel a great confidence in. It's, you know, in terms of being able to refer to something which, you know, these ethical principles. Okay, can I'll paraphrase it or try to?
Okay.
Or do you want the microphone?
It might be a bit to paraphrase it. I'd have to kind of really narrow it down. Should I just say something? I just wanted to say, it was something I just said to Chris, and it's just something about how kind of powerless language is to communicate consciousness, in my opinion. I mean, I've got a lot of respect for intellectual pursuits, you know, and getting right view together through study, thrashing out kind of wrong views and things like that. But in my own practice anyway, sort of more and more recently, I suppose there's just been more and more of an urge to just be. And I suppose sort of what I was thinking of really is that... Well, this is how I experience anyway. It's as soon as I kind of go into the realm of language, it feels a little bit like I've left my direct experience, just a little bit. I don't quite know how to be both in language and in my direct experience. And from what I understand, you have this sort of two Buddhist consciousness split. You have vijnana and jnana, and vijnana is the sort of discriminative consciousness, i.e. kind of when we're in the mode of language and analysing things and things like that. And then jnana is this sort of, well, what is it? It's a non-dual awareness, you know, which probably doesn't get us any closer, does it? But it's just a total being with the immediate experience or something like that. And I caught myself walking down Market Street one day trying to sort of work out the existential situation of the world, you know, as I often seem to do. And I just remember having this experience, Prabhasvara, you'll never work it out with language. You'll never work it out with thought and etc. And we have an interesting paradox, don't we, with this whole course, really, because we're trying to sort of use language to get to consciousness, which I really, really believe can only be experienced directly. You have this thing coming up, like, of primordial knowing,
or something like that. And, you know, if I really sort of take some time out to look at that pillar, some sort of merging kind of seems to happen, you know, where it feels like I'm in touch with something. Whereas if I try to write an essay about that pillar or something like that, I don't. So I don't think that's sort of very heretical, but it, you know, it seems to be in line with my experience. So I wondered if you had anything to say about that, either of you.
I mean, Chris, I'll just say one thing. I mean, one thing, I think language is extremely important. Maybe not to, I don't think, you know, I agree with you, you know, concepts and language, which is an expression of concepts, is not going to get to the mystery of consciousness. That, I think that's going to be got in through, in for me anyway, Buddhist practice. But I do, you know, I think language is extremely important in terms it allows empathy. And, you know, one thing we touched upon last week was the importance of language, because for language to arise, to be able to happen, there's two specific parts of the brain which evolved, you know, the Wienck region and the Broca region, which are kind of unique to our brains. And I think that kind of reflects just how important language is in terms of being able to communicate. Well, I mean, you can see, you know, you can communicate, you can organise hunting groups, you can be tactical in your hunting. You can say, right, go over there, you know, or whatever. But I think, you know, particularly in Buddhist practice now, you know, language is extremely important in allowing empathy, you know. So you can tell me how you feel if I say a certain thing, and I can learn from that. So I agree with you. I think when it starts going into conscious, yeah, you let meditation and reflection do that. But it's, I think it's very important in metta. Sorry.
Can I just add one thing?
Yeah.
Okay. According to modern linguistic theory, or some that I've read, it's like they say that there can be no I, sense of self, without language.
Yeah, yes.
Language chops experience up, in a sense. So there can be no view of self, as it were, without that linguistic distinction between mummy and young Mickey, or, you know, whatever it is. Yeah, and I find that quite fascinating, actually, as well.
Thank you. Sorry, Sukadi wants to say something. Do you want to say anything?
I just wanted to say, actually, that thinking about what you were just saying is that it's the insight that you got as you were walking down the street that sticks with you, not the words have how you describe the insight, isn't it? And when often, you know, I'm a lot newer to this than many of you, but when you get one of those flashes of insight, you think, oh, that's what it is, it's blah. But actually the words fade quite quickly, and I can remember I've had insights even while sitting here meditating, and they've gone. But somehow the feeling of the insight often hasn't gone. So in that case, in those sort of cases, languages can very, very weak, really. And the whole of Western philosophy doesn't, well, that I've come across, the bits that I've come across, doesn't discuss the whole idea of being at all, just being. There's no discussion about that. It doesn't see it as scientific enough to be worthy, which is very unfair.
Okay, well, I was intrigued by this because I think, if I understood you correctly, at one point you were discussing language and how semantics helps, you know, the developing individual to make sense of the world, communication within oneself, so consciousness. But my experience is when I'm learning, I'm definitely going beyond what I can describe. And therefore, I don't have words for that particular thing as yet. So therefore, developing human being, and therefore consciousness, at least in my experience, goes beyond words. Regularity, you know, regularly, I'm intrigued by that because you seem to be implying that actually language is necessary for consciousness, or at least self-consciousness, you know, to arise. But my experience is, I'm not so sure. You know, say for instance, I do singing exercises. I used to, you know, sing as a tenor, and very, very quickly, when I would discover something new, I'd run out of words, and it was more like a feel or you know, of what was going on. Yeah, so that seems to contradict, in a way, the necessity for semantics, if you like, in terms of, you know, helping the consciousness to develop apart from communicating with others.
You think the language then follows quickly after? So the language develops as well, but following on.
It seems that way, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well.
Okay, I was just saying that it seems that, yeah, I agree, but it seems the language somehow follows afterwards. So you have the experience and the knowing and the feeling of the new meaning that you've discovered, and then you develop a language to go with it afterwards. And but that's often rather a pale reflection of what you just learned.
You see, I thought language was were actually symbols. You know, the same concepts, they're symbols. So words are symbols, and therefore they are able to point beyond themselves. And therefore you're able to learn, for instance, mm-hmm. you know, both by articulating to yourself, this is what's happening, as well as the reverse, it seems to me.
But it seems to be both ways round, that's the trouble, that makes it so confusing.
I was reading a study, this sounds very obscure, 2 days ago, about deaf children, and this sort of answers what you're saying. I'm trying to explain what I read now, because I didn't fully understand it at the time. That deaf children who are taught to sign develop in a very, very different way to children who are not taught to sign in terms of how they communicate. And now I'm thinking about what you've said, that maybe language is a gateway to developing consciousness rather than a necessity for consciousness. Because why were these kids could catch up, but they really struggled in terms of how they communicated if they weren't given a structure. And maybe that's all that language is, or the end product. But not essential, they still developed. They just developed differently and more slowly in our constraints of what development is. We used to say they couldn't do things we couldn't see and perceive because they couldn't tell us. Don't know.
Is the signing then just a different type of language?
Yeah, well, I that's what I've assumed, it's a type of language. But the ones that weren't taught to formally sign would still communicate. But not in a way that, A, they could be understood by anybody else, or they could be, but not in a sophisticated a manner. Just, so where is language? Was my question. I'm sort of trying to answer it as well and failing.
I'd just like to say that language, to me, connecting with people is extremely important, but my inner language is a pain in the backside. And it gets in the way of everything that I want to achieve. And I think if I can get rid of my language that lies within, I'd be a lot better off, because the feelings I gain from being absorbed in a task doesn't need to be put into words. Therefore, it's not my language, it's not the need to express myself, it's the body, it's the physical or the spiritual that I'm feeling. And therefore, language to me, from my experience, isn't important unless it's communicating with other people. Communicating with myself is a daily nightmare that I wish I didn't have to go through, which is why I need to be here practicing Buddhism, meditation and awareness. I don't know whether you agree with that or not, but language definitely is a barrier to me, and I'll stand to be corrected.
It really follows on from what the last two speakers have said, which is that I'm interested in consciousness as something which changes. So it's not something that's fixed, it's something that's affected, whether you're taught to sign, to communicate in a certain way, or whether you're taught beliefs that mean that you speak to yourself in a certain way every day. So I think what I'm doing as a Buddhist is trying to change my consciousness, it's trying to change what I believe, and to bring into awareness when you talked about sorry, is that Aidan?
Yes.
Yeah, when you talked about communicating with yourself as a living nightmare, I think it's trying to bring that critical self-talk into awareness and transform it. Because what I think, and then what I think releases an emotion, which then gives me a physical state to which I respond, and that becomes my consciousness. If I think something and believe something and act something every single day of my life, that changes who I am. So why I'm interested in these discussions on consciousness is thinking, well, what do I do with it? What do I do with my environment? What do I do with my actions? So, are you going to do that next week? Great.
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that people kind of often, you know, agree distinguishes us from the animals is well, it's like in that film 2001 where the ape sort of, you know, finds the bone and starts hitting the other ape with it. You know, it's like he's made a tool sort of thing. And I think the way that came about was that he did the first sort of abstraction, you know. So it's a bit like, you know, you've got a hillside that's all brushwood and stuff like that, and then lightning strikes it and it turns into fire, but all the animals just run away from it. But at some point, somebody some human would have made some sort of abstraction about that, you know, fire on the hillside, make fire, you know. So the whole thing of abstraction gives us a capacity to manipulate the world and to do work and things, you know. So that's what, you know, that's really useful, you know. It means we can do all sorts of stuff. We can do science, you know, and do all that sort of stuff. But it's a bit of a curse as well, you know, because we're constantly doing it whether we like it or not, you know. And I think, you know, the Buddhist sort of view about, I suppose, abstraction or having views is that you just see them as view. Well, you try and have right view, which is to see something correctly, you know. So if I look at that table and I say to myself, oh, table, but I really don't see it as something fixed, you know, I see it as a sort of impermanent, you know, kind of mixture of things that's going to pass away. That's more of a right view than kind of thinking table and kind of clinging to it. So we need to do that assessment, you know. But it's like with views, you become less and less attached to them. You use them in a fluid sort of way. You know, you use language in a fluid sort of way. And, you know, you try and be sort of more and more accurate about the way that you see things. You know, so how you see yourself, how you see other people. You know, you see them more correctly. You know, you see them as centres of experience. You see them as impermanent. You know, all the things that are important. And you try not see them as things that are kind of not true or irrelevant or all those sort of things, you know. So I think, you know, the thing of, like, language is that process of, I mean, I think, you know, in cognitive therapy, they use the term Socratic questioning. So you question your own thoughts, you know. If you've got a thought, you know, nobody loves me, and you feel a bit depressed about that, you know, you don't just accept the thought as a given. You sort of say, well, hang on, you know, what's the evidence for and against? And you write it all down, and then you come up with a more balanced thought, which sort of changes your view then, or changes your mood and makes you a bit sort of less depressed. So it's like, you know, we need to work on our thoughts and work on our assessments of things, you know. So that's one side of things. That's like the wisdom aspect. But the other side is like the more sort of consciousness aspect, the what's called citta. So it's a bit like more states of mind that you get into. So you develop that into more positive states of mind that aren't necessarily discursive, you know. So higher states of consciousness, you know, elevated states of, well, which end up in sort of compassion. So you end up with, like, wisdom on the one hand, how you assess things, and compassion on the other, as to how you respond to the world, you know, what you bring in terms of your state of mind sort of thing. So I think, you know, it's worth bearing those two things in mind, you know, that you know, consciousness has that sort of, it's you know, ethical states of mind as well as sort of, you know, language and assessment and stuff.
Thank you. Do you want to meditate for 10 minutes? Just sit quietly. Or is somebody got one last burning question? Is there one? If not, we'll just sit quietly. Okay.
Is it burning? Yeah. Okay. Okay. Burn away.
And it's gonna ask, this is a question, actually, more than a statement. I was taught, you can disagree with me here or not, that roughly 30% of the brain is functions consciously, and the rest of it, 70%, is subconscious. And I've heard 10-90, but I've heard 30-70 most. But the brain is an amorphous mass of neurons and substances, and so it doesn't quite hold true with me that it's such a clear-cut boundary. And I'm really sort of curious, probably, I should have come to the science lecture. I didn't know it was happening until afterwards. Because that just strikes me as such a medical approach, as in we have cardiologists, yeah. We have lung specialists, yeah. We have conscious brain specialists and subconscious brain bollocks. Yeah. And it just, what are your views on that? where does consciousness cease to be consciousness and become subconsciousness?
Okay, this is very easy. I don't know. I don't know. I think that there you're getting into the realms of literalism, and it really, to be honest, that's not an important question for me. What is important is I do believe that, you know, part of my Buddhist practice over the years has been bringing more and more of the unconscious into my conscious, and the more the more of the unconscious I know, the better, really. So. And I think, you know, the whole symbolism of the enlightenment of the Buddha is to do with, you know, the explosion of some of the elements of unconsciousness into consciousness. So I don't know. What does philosophy
say to that? That's an interesting one altogether. I think Maharaj would agree, but I don't know, this is the philosophy of the science, but surely you can't say that there's this part 70% unconscious and 30% conscious, or whatever the figure is, because it's moving around sections of the brain anyway. So it's expanding from a small amount of consciousness to a large amount, then it's conscious here, but then it's now subconscious there or unconscious there, and so on. So this keeps changing. Obviously, there are lower parts of your brain, perhaps, that can't ever be described as conscious, but large amounts of it can play a part in consciousness at any one different time. So it's impossible to say, really, which bit is conscious and which bit isn't.
Okay, are you satisfied with that? Okay, well, we've been doing a lot of heady stuff, so let's just settle into our bodies, become aware of our experience, just quietly, and we'll leave at 7:30. So we've got about 8 minutes to do that.